Okay, it's me, Ross Hemsworth, and you're in the first hour of Now That's Weird. My guest this evening from South Wales in Cardiff is the Reverend Lionel Fenthorpe. Now, Lionel, got a few emails here for you. Now,
I'm just
going to ask you a big favour before we go into the emails. I've just actually received an email from Nita Grant. Now, Nita is my second guest on the show this evening, doing the second hour about alien abductions and sex with aliens, would you believe? And she said she's enjoying you so much. Could you do a little bit longer?
Well, that's a wonderful compliment, but can we run till, say, maybe 5 past, because I've got a couple of other jobs I have to finish tonight. You know what my schedule's like.
I know. Yes, that's brilliant. An extra 5 minutes will give us a bit of time to just cover some of the things that we've not been able to fit in, so that'll be fantastic. Appreciated. And also, Penny says, if you and Patricia are down in Devon any time, you must come in and have lunch or dinner with us.
We would love that. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, I owe you one anyway from the last time.
Just drop us an email so we know where to come and when, and we'll try and fix something up.
Fantastic. Okay, let's go through these emails. Got one here from Betsy. Betsy's in New Zealand. She said, it's damned early here, but I had to get up and listen to Lionel. And she said, I need to know, you were talking earlier about ghosts. Have you actually seen a ghost?
I have not seen one in the sense that I've seen a friend standing in front of me when we're having a pint. But the nearest I've ever come to it is seeing it inside my mind. I used to teach in Cambridge with a very good friend called Billy Farrer, and Bill was like a brother to me. He was told that he was terminally ill, and he asked me to take his funeral. Well, of course, I saw as much of him as I could while he was still with us. And then I got a phone call from the village priest saying, Lionel, I'm so sorry, but Bill has just died. And can you come over and do the funeral as promised, and we'll bury him in my churchyard. So I drove over from Cardiff after the day's work, and I got to Cambridge about midnight, and we were sitting together on the couch, Father Ian and myself, and we were going through the prayer book at the funeral page. You do this piece, I'll do that piece, I'll pay the tribute to him, so on and so on. And suddenly, more like a dream or watching a really vivid video, I could see Bill standing behind the couch. He looked 30 years younger. He was radiant with health. He had his arms around our shoulders, and with a huge smile, he said, now I couldn't have recorded it with a tape recorder, but I could hear the words inside my head like you do in a dream. And he was saying, it's really good of you two boys to go to all this trouble for me when you've done a long day's work. And then he said this, Lionel, tell Father Ian that Lady Juliana of Norwich was absolutely right. Well, I'm not a psychic, I'm an investigator. I've never had an experience like this before. And I thought, I'm going to make an idiot of myself. But I thought, just in case this is real, open-minded investigator, I said to Ian, the other priest, Ian, Billy is here with us in the room, and he's asked me to tell you Lady Juliana of Norwich was right. And Ian moved away as if he'd had an electric shock, and he said, you couldn't possibly have known this, but when Bill slipped away in the intensive care, I was holding his hand, and the last thing I said to him was, Billy, remember the words of Lady Juliana when she had that vision of heaven, went into a trance, came back. Other nuns asked her, Juliana, what was it like? And all she could say was, all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well, in the rather quaint prose of the 15th century. And he said, the last thing I said to Billy was that Lady Juliana said, heaven is wonderful. And you've just told me that Billy's come back to see us to say, Ian, you were right, Juliana was right, heaven is absolutely wonderful.
That's amazing. What an amazing story.
A true story. And the nearest I've come to age, I felt if I'd turned round, I'd have seen him. But I was facing the front of the Bill was behind us with his arms round our shoulders.
Fantastic. Okay, another email, moving swiftly on from that one. We've got one here from John, who's in Scotland, something a bit closer to home. And John says, do you get problems with the bishop and archbishop with reference to your thoughts and your other areas of interest in the paranormal?
Right. Well, to start start with, I just need to explain that although I am a fully ordained Anglican priest working in the church in Wales, that in the church in Wales, particularly, we have a number of guys like me who are non-stipendiary. We're fully trained, fully ordained, but we like to do what we do for the sake of the church. We don't take a salary, we don't take a church house, we don't take a church car, and the church doesn't pay the phone bills. We're totally financially independent. Now, I've got a friend who, until he retired, was a priest and an optician. Another one is a priest and a solicitor. Another one was a priest and a pharmacist. I'm a priest and a writer, broadcaster, and investigator. So that you have far more freedom and independence. And if a bishop or an archbishop, I mean, if you're a young curate and you're in a church house and you have a wife and two young children, and somebody up the hierarchy goes, tut, tut, I think you're being, you know, doing things I don't like, then the poor, timid little curate will think, gosh, I mustn't lose my house and salary. I've got a family to look after. But in my case, as I said, I have the glorious advantage of being a volunteer. And as I said, I've never been afflicted with timidity. If a bishop wants to argue with me, he's welcome.
Good luck to him. He'd need it, wouldn't he? Penny's got the next one. Oh, I forgot to mention you're a black belt in, was it Taekwondo or something?
I'm judo. Yeah, I'm a third dan judo instructor, yeah.
Yeah, so he doesn't want to argue too much, does he?
I still keep it up when I can.
Penny's got one for you, and this is going to get you, because there's about four questions all tied into one here. She said she wants to know about Esther Cox and the Amherst Poltergeist, plus your thoughts on Poltergeist in general, Maria Martin and the Red Barn, Strange Dreams, and if not, which books can she get quickly that cover these subjects?
Right. Well, the first thing is that my book on the world's greatest unsolved mysteries covers most of those. The Amherst Poltergeist, I'll have to be really quick on this one for you, for Penny and for you, Russ. The Amherst Poltergeist is probably the most spectacular poltergeist case ever recorded, and it's wonderfully authenticated. A girl called Esther Cox in Amherst in Nova Scotia was, first of all, she and her sister were sharing a room, and they saw a cardboard box moving. They thought there was a mouse or a rat underneath it, and when they turned the box over, there was nothing there. They were then, as in a number of classical poltergeist cases, they found the bedclothes were pulled off, and the bed sort of turned into a trampoline, and there were all kinds of weird physical manifestations, the most important of which, from your point of view and mine and our listeners, as interested investigators who like to have real evidence. She had gone to stay with a friend who ran a restaurant, and she was sitting in the kitchen while he was serving customers, and this is in Victorian times, 19th century, a big wrought iron oven door flies off of its own accord and sails across the kitchen. She couldn't believe it. She picked it up and put it back on the oven. Within 2 minutes, it had sailed across again. This time, she was really frightened. She goes for her friend, who's the restaurant owner. He puts it back. He wedges it with a hickory stick that was an axe handle that happened to be lying around. And the thing threw the hickory stick off and leapt away again. He ran out into the street to find a really unimpeachable witness, and he came back with a government officer who was a fisheries inspector. The two of them put the oven door back on, wedged it with the axe handle, hickory axe handle, again, and it happened in front of Etta, her friend, and the fisheries inspector, and was duly recorded. I have never come across a poltergeist case other than that one, which had such an amazing, shall we say, factual record made of it. The idea about poltergeists in general, there's a very wide pool of evidence to suggest that they may emanate from the human mind. The power of the mind is something we need to investigate. We haven't a clue about how vast the power of the subconscious might be. And in a number of poltergeist cases, it looks as if, perhaps, you know, rather like the little bit of grit that gets into the shell of the oyster and produces the pearl, there may be a tiny piece of an external entity that uses, it's rather like a little person getting behind the controls of a 30-ton Arctic and driving it down the road. The 30-ton Arctic, the power, that is in the mind of the human being who's being used by whatever a poltergeist is. That would be my general theory of poltergeists. The Maria Martin case is an amazing one, and Maria Martin from Polstead in Suffolk was the girlfriend of a farmer named Foxy Corder, who was a rather unpleasant piece of work, and Maria Martin was murdered. Her body was hidden under the floor of the barn on Corder's farm. And although it tells us in most of the literature that it was her mother who had the dream, it wasn't. Her mother was dead. And the new Mrs. Martin wasn't much older than Maria. And it was she who had the strange dreams which led to the discovery of Maria's body and the arrest and execution of Corder. Now, I have a theory about this, that having gone into it in great depth, the Victorian melodramas about Maria Martin make her out to be an innocent teenager, and Corder is much older and is a seducer. And that's not true. Maria was 24. She already had two illegitimate children by different fathers. Corder was younger than she was. I suspect that because Corder was a wealthy farmer, the young Mrs. Martin, Maria's stepmother, had rather set her cap at Corder, and she and her stepdaughter were rivals for Corder's hand. There was a quarrel in the barn between Corder and Maria Martin. She attacked Corder, who shot her in self-defense because he wasn't very big and she was a big, strapping farm lady. This was witnessed by the stepmother. And she does a deal with Corder. If you agree to marry me as soon as I'm widowed from old Mr. Martin, then I'll shut up about the murder. She discovered 6 months later Corder had married a young schoolmistress in London. Now she's in a cleft stick. She can't go along and say, I saw him do the murder. Otherwise she becomes an accessory and is equally guilty. And so, in a rather superstitious time, she hits on the idea, I'm going to pretend I've had a dream. And she persuades her husband and the farm bailiff to dig in the barn. Maria's body is found, Corder is arrested, and the rest is history. But I think the dream in the Martin case may not have been a paranormal mystery, but a mystery of vengeance. Now, the final one on the mysterious dreams, because I do believe dreams can have amazing significance and can be very mysterious, is the one I went to school in the little town of Swaffham in Norfolk, and our local hero in Swaffham, who appears on the town sign, was a guy called John Chapman. And John dreamt that if he went to London and stood on London Bridge, he would hear something that would make him rich, famous. He duly went to London. Nothing happened for 3 days. A local resident of one of the houses then built on London Bridge came across and said, are you a criminal? You're watching to see when we go out. And he said, no, no. And he said, I'm just a poor idiot who thought that if I came here, I'd hear good news about, you know, make me rich and famous. And the man he was talking to roared with laughter and said, you are an idiot indeed. He said, I had a funny dream the other night. He said, I dreamt of a town called Swaffham, which I've never visited. And I dreamt that in the garden of a peddler was an apple tree. And underneath it was a crock of Roman gold. So John changed the subject, thanked him profoundly, zoomed back to Swaffham, called his wife out in the middle of the night with a lantern and a spade, and lo and behold, under their apple tree was a crock of Roman gold, and he used it to help the poor and to endow an extension to Swaffham Church. Now there was a genuinely mysterious dream, as opposed opposed to the Mariah Martin dream, which could have been a criminal subterfuge.
What a fantastic story. Lionel, we've run out of time, bearing in mind your own time limits there and the things that you've got to do. But thanks for staying with us for those extra few minutes. I really appreciate that. And we're going to have you back on the show again fairly soon, because I still want to talk to you about the Oak Island Money Pit. I also want to talk to you about consciousness, the universal consciousness, and the effects on our minds and the strength of the mind against the brain. There's so many areas that we've just not managed to get into this evening. So hopefully, if we can squeeze into your tight schedule another day, I'd love to get you back on the show.
I'd be delighted to do it, Ross. That's a very great compliment. You know the old joke that Oscar Wilde said, he's a very popular man, he's invited everywhere once. It's when your friends ask you back, it's a lovely compliment, and thank you, and I'd love to come.
That's fantastic. Lionel, thank you very much indeed for being on the show this evening. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, as I know have my listeners. Sorry for all those that have sent emails and texts in that we've not been able to get onto the programme, but we always knew this was going to be a very popular guest. So, Lionel, thank you very much.
Real pleasure. Good night, and God bless you all.